I'm your host, Nick Giacomis, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Mario Capecchi. Dr. Capecchi is a professor of genetics at the University of Utah, where he's been running a lab for many decades now. He is a recipient of the Nobel Prize, which he won in 2007 for his contributions to creating technology that allows us to make knockout animals, to knock out particular genes by deleting segments of DNA, thereby allowing us to understand what those genes are actually doing. He has had an illustrious career spanning many decades. He has worked in areas ranging from developmental biology to cancer biology, and most recently, neurobiology. And so we talked a little bit about some of his current work, looking at the role of microglia, immune cells in the brain, and what role they play in things like anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. We talked about some of his work that led to the Nobel Prize, how he developed the technology to make knockout mice, to understand how to delete certain segments of DNA in animals. And we talked about his entire career and his entire life. We talked about, you know, how he got into molecular biology. We talked about his early life, which is a remarkable, remarkable story. He was an orphan for a number of years, living on the streets of Italy during World War II, separated from his mother. He eventually immigrated to New York, in the United States. He learned English and assimilated and got an education, eventually getting a PhD in biophysics under James Watson at Harvard University, and, you know, going on to have, you know, the illustrious career that I already mentioned. So, you know, we talked about his entire life, really, which is an amazing, amazing life story. We talked about how, you know, the experiences he had in childhood and his early years impacted who he became and the type of scientist he is. We talked about, you know, why he has switched fields so many times and the value that he sees in that and how he thinks about his science, how he approaches it. He's 85 years old, but still running a lab, going into the lab every day, mentoring students, doing experiments himself. And you know, he's still sharp. And, you know, he talked about his diet. He talked about his exercise routine. He's apparently still exercising strenuously for about 4 hours per day, everything from rowing to lifting weights. And so we just talked about his entire approach to his life and his science. And he provided a lot of interesting, I think, life lessons and a lot of insights, especially for aspiring scientists in terms of, you know, what they should focus on and how they should think about going about their science. So if you're interested in neurobiology and things like OCD and anxiety, we talked about the science that he's working on today. But if you're interested in, you know, the scientific process and just hearing an amazing story about a remarkable individual, this was a really interesting episode. I had a lot of fun talking to Mario and note about his work for, you know, for many, many years, and it was a real privilege to get to sit down and speak with him. As always, if you enjoy the content I'm producing, please like, share, and subscribe. Don't forget to check out the links in the episode description to learn how you can support the podcast further, and check out mindandmatter.substack.com for long-form science writing, all my podcast content, and the latest updates. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form, and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it with the first meal of each day, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure, and vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things, and there's even evidence indicating that vitamin D deficiency is correlated with more severe cases of COVID-19 in those who get infected. Every time I go into the doctor each year for a checkup, I'm always told that vitamin D deficiency is very common and I should be supplementing on a daily basis. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Mario Capecchi. Can you just tell me a little bit about who you are and what your lab does?
Mario Capecchi, I'm a professor at the University of Utah. And I've been here forever. I mainly do research and some teaching. My research is one of the properties of my research is that every 10 years I change subjects completely. And that's a real transformation in the sense, not only the information content, but also social content. For example, we go to meetings and now you need entirely new people because he's not working on cancer, which was what we were just previously working on. And now we're neurobiologists. And so we're talking to neuroscientists. And these are, I enjoy that process and I've done it, literally every 10 years or so of my whole career. And I think, in a sense, it's important because I'm naive. I don't know the questions I should be asking. And I go into a crowd and then, and first of all, you always have to start at the bottom and then work your way up. So it's a rejuvenating process, I think, because it's a, your mind loves to be challenged. And as long as you challenge it, it's active. And if you don't challenge it, then it goes to sleep.
And so is that like a conscious choice to switch fields after
Yes.
a number of years? Okay, so
Yeah.
it's not
And I
okay.
look ahead and think about where I want to go next. And then I often teach a course in it. So I really get to have to get into the literature and be able to talk to students. And from then on, for 10 years, I'll stick with it. And right now we're in year three of neuroscience.
Wow, so you're most well known for your work in molecular biology and genetics, and I definitely want to ask you about some of that. But you're in neurobiology now. What kind of questions are you asking? What's exciting that you're working on?
We're primarily working on two neuropsychiatric disorders, anxiety and OCD. And they often occur together. That is in our mice, it's 100%. In humans, it's about 80%. And the question is why are working together? What is and we've you know by we also apply new technologies. I mean, I'm very technology centered, having developed technology and then having to utilize. And most people are not comfortable changing, but in science, actually, you have to change. It's absolutely demanding. And I think one of the things that happens is that inflows a new technology, and then everybody's excited about it and utilize it and see what happens with it. And sometimes you get a lot of surprises. For example, optogenetics has been around for a while, but nobody's ever done optogenetics in cells other than neurons. So we decided to work on a population that isn't neurons, but they are in the brain. They're called microglia. They're the immune cell of the brain. And to our surprise, we activate microglia in specific regions of the brain, and we turn on behaviors. We turn off the light, the laser, and then the behavior stops. Okay,
So
so we, yep.
these are the immune cells of the brain, so
Yeah.
they don't fire action potentials like
No,
neurons. They're
that's right.
like white blood cells. You turn them on, you get behaviors. What kind of behaviors?
And in this case, anxiety and OCD. And that's why we're studying those. And the other thing we've d discovered, I mean, the dogma was that there's only a single population of microglia. And we come along and say, well, maybe I think there's a second population. And there's resistance, obviously. They're used to one population. They don't want to think about two populations. But all of a sudden, not only is there two populations, but actually, you should have anticipated you need two populations. I mean, biology wouldn't have it if it doesn't need it. And the question is, why do you have two populations? And it turned out they work in opposition to each other, not in parallel. One of them increases the behavior, the other decreases the behavior. And then together, they can now set a new set point. Depending on the conditions that are in the environment. So it allows them a very sensitive system to be able to shift the level of anxiety. Both grooming, what we see as OCD is over-grooming, pathological grooming. The mice continue to groom until they actually have lacerations. And both behaviors are dependent on essentially microglia controlling them. Obviously, they're not, the neurons are controlling all the actual making behavior, but the microglia are talking to the, and then controlling the level of behavior output.
So do we know how they're actually doing that? So how are they actually modulating neural activity?
That we don't know. We don't know the neurons they're talking to yet. That's the next step. I mean, right now, we know they're talking, but we don't know the conversation, and we don't know, for example, is it ligands or is it direct electrical contacts? Because, you know, all cells have essentially membrane potentials, and they can, and their membrane potential can change with influx of ions. And here, if we use optogenetics to pump it in terms of light, then we're affecting their behavior and changing the output of the microglia, which then talk to neurons, and then they respond. And we're interested in that conversation, but we're just setting up the tools to be able to measure that conversation.
And so, you're still going into the lab every day, and you're still doing research. Yeah.
Full 100%.
So how much of that is just, you know, what sort of what keeps, for those who don't know, and we'll talk about this, you know, you're in your mid 80s, you've won the Nobel Prize, you've sort of you've done it all, so to speak, career wise. What's keeping you going in every day for such a difficult job?
I think curiosity. I mean, I think what's, you know, when you see something completely unexpected, then you have an aha period. And that's, you know, that's a rush. And it's fun. And I think that's essentially, I'm not out to prove anything now. I simply enjoy the science. And the, you know, it's almost like a confrontation between nature and yourself. She knows how everything's happening, and you don't. You can see what she's doing, but you have no idea how she's doing it. And so then the question is, you know, how can we figure that out? And then and eventually, can we use it then to actually help in the sense of being, you know, anxiety is an enormous problem, especially right now. I mean, COVID has just raised the roof, and it's just rampant all over the world. And now we have... And the other thing one always has to keep in mind is a little anxiety is fantastic. It keeps you, you know, it keeps you co-focused, essentially. It allows you to pursue something rather than be distracted. Similarly with grooming, small amounts of grooming are gratifying, but pathological ones, which lead to lacerations, is pathology. So it's important to have the right level of both behaviors at the right time, depending on what's happening in the outside world relative to yourself.
And so, you know, you said you like to decide to switch fields, you know, every 10 years or so. You've gotten into neurobiology, you're studying microglia and how they impact the nervous system in the context of OCD and anxiety. How did you pick that field as opposed to just some other area of neuroscience?
At one stage, we worked in developmental biology, then went into cancer biology, and then into neurobiology. When I was in developmental biology, we were interested in a group of genes called Hox genes, and they're involved in specifying the body plan. They make sure our head is here and our arms are at the right place and all the organs are in the right place and so on. It's a coordination system. But we knocked out one gene, and rather than getting some change in body plan, we actually got a behavioral change. And it was very obvious because these mice were moving all their body here. Okay. And it was a surprise, you know. The bodies were fine, but they had this pathological overgrooming phenotype. And so that interests me, you know, why? Because it's an oddball. Here you have 39 genes all involved in making your body, and this was interested in behavior. So... we always kept that in my mind, and then I decided this is the entry point where I'm going to find out, you know, why do Hox genes control behaviors?
Yeah, and so for those who don't know, what are Hox genes, and what, you know, what is their basic most well-established function?
Hox genes are transcription factors, so they're turning on and turning off genes, and they're a very specific cluster of genes. There are 39 of them, and it's true in mice, it's true in humans, and they're involved essentially in all aspects of making body plans. And they're used by all organisms, a multicellular organism, to control their body plans. I mean, the first thing you decided is, you know, you go from a ball to a football, okay, something much smaller. So now you have a dimension, okay, and oxygens are involved in setting up that axis. And they set up axes, you know, in all three dimensions, essentially, in the body, and then allow you to make sure that all the parts of the body are in the right place and can connect up and then be functional. It's a fascinating group of genes, and they're they do amazing things. You know, and, you know, just they were first discovered in Drosophila. All of a sudden, an antenna would be coming out of your head. That's a function of a hot sheet. Okay, that's responsible for those aberrations. And just as I was developing gene targeting, the hox genes were being discovered, and particularly that hox genes may be more organisms than besides Drosophila. So the question was, okay, what are they doing in mice? And so that's how we got into developmental biology. So we always have an entry point and an interest point, and then from there we develop the conversation.
I see. So these hox genes are involved in setting up the body plan, which side's the head, which mm-hmm. side's the tail, yeah. you know, where everything's right. going to go, what it's going to turn right. into in terms of body parts. So normally, yeah. I'm guessing, you know, you delete a hox gene or you mess with a hox gene, you get right. a body plan defect, a body That's part right. goes in the wrong and, spot or
and
something.
Very, in a very particular region. So one hox gene will be operating in this part of the chest, another one just below it, and another one above it. Okay, so we always knew, for example, when we made hox mutations, there would be something wrong with the body, and we would look at what particular part of the body and then see what's happening. Are they involved in limb development? Not only are they involved in limb development, are they involved in making the fingers? Because that's a change in the anterior posterior direction of the limb. Okay. So they're involved in literally in all those places, and they have to be able to do that. But then we all of a sudden saw one that it's called HOXB8 that's involved essentially now in controlling behavior. And so then we got really interested in that aspect, but required us to change fields in essence.
So you knocked out that gene and you didn't see any body plan defects. It was only a behavioral change.
Yeah, no, the body plans are normal. And then the only thing that was apparent was that a lot of hair was missing, and then that it progresses because these animals can't stop. They just keep on going.
Interesting. And so that just triggers you to get into a new field. So it sounds like you're yep. kind of always looking or waiting for yep. an oddball like that, and that
That's
just
right.
takes you in a new direction.
Yeah, and then we have, you know, we have an entry point, and then we have to acquire a new technology in order to study it in their terms, and therefore we get into optogenetics. We get into, you know, we have little cameras that are smaller than a little finger, a little fingernail that we can insert into the brain, and then it can monitor cells moving around in the brain, particularly microglia, because we make them fluorescently red or whatever color we want. And so we can watch them and see where they are and then activate them, for example, with a laser.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we've already mentioned, knockout technology. So this yes. is, you know, technology that enables scientists to remove genes or segments of DNA. And when you take it away, you basically look to see what's broken, and then you can figure out what that gene's doing. So this is actually what you're probably most famous for. This is, the Nobel Prize in 2007 was given to you and a couple others for discoveries of principles for introducing specific gene modifications in mice by the use of embryonic stem cells. And this was the knockout gene technology. For the uninitiated, can you just explain In basic terms, what does this technology do and how does it work?
I mean, first you have to identify a gene you want to manipulate. And we can put it into a vector which makes lots of it. And so then we can change it, literally change the sequence. And we can change one base pair or 10 base pairs or thousands of base pairs. And one of the first things you often do is simply delete a gene that is a sequence responsible for making that gene, and then see essentially what the consequences, as you mentioned, all of a sudden, little finger disappears, and we know we're in the program for making little finger. And it's always that, what you do is perturb the system and then ask what the function is determined by the perturbation you see. And that gives you a clue, essentially, what this gene is doing. And what was amazing in the beginning is, our concept of which genes were doing what was completely wrong. Nobody could predict what the consequences would be in a mouse if you removed HOXB7 or 8 or whatever. But you always infer the function from what you see in the animal. And that gives you enormous power. And then once you identify the gene, then we can start changing it in any way we want. We can put in markers that fluoresce red or green or yellow or whatever. And that allows us to then follow those cells in the live animal. And again, it's like, the technology is always in vivo. It's always in the live animal, because we cannot really, even that today, we don't have the capability of studying complex phenomena except in the animal itself, and do the perturbation in the animal and then see what the consequences, and then really realize what the function is. And I think it's up to the imagination what you do with that. Once you have the technology, you could do anything you want with it. There were thousands of genes that we had no idea what they were doing. And the question was, which ones are you going to study? Okay. And I decided, Hox genes would be a great entry point, because we know they do dramatic things in Drosophila, flies. So the question is, are they doing the similar things in a mammal? And then take the ball once you have it and run with it.
And when you developed that technology, was that work that you were doing in your lab at the University of Utah? And when was that happening? Yeah.
No, we started the project. I was thinking about the project just before coming to Utah, but we actually started all the work here. Sometimes you do science by serendipity. All of a sudden, you see something you didn't expect. But in this case, we actually planned it. I planned it in the sense I knew what organism I wanted to do, mice. And I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to change genes, because there was no other way to do genetics in a mouse. And we, in Drosophila, we can select for mutations because you can work with enormous numbers. In mice, we can work with large numbers, but not enormous numbers. If nobody could afford it. There you had to use very different genetics. We couldn't mutagenize and look for the mutation. We had to create it. And it was obvious we had to create it. And we had to be very specific. We didn't want to just blade it. We wanted to be able to change specific nucleotides so that we could have power to change a gene in any way we wanted. Often you want to make more of the gene product rather than less of the gene product, or make it in a new area of the body that's normally, that gene doesn't function. So all of those manipulations are doable by gene targeting.
And so what's the timeline here? When was this work happening? Like, when did you start your
this
lab?
This is happening. I came to Utah in 73. And so started really seriously probably in 75. And one of the first things you do when you want to do work is try to get a grant. So you submit it to NIH, and I thought, I was very excited. They sent it back a very good study section. I actually knew who the people were, and actually personally knew some of them. And their response was impossible. Obviously, no money. And so all of a sudden you have a big question to do. What are you going to do with that information? Are you going to quit, do a new project, or do you have the guts to actually continue that project? And I decided I would go for it. An enormous risk. 4 years later, if I'd failed, I would be done.
Okay. Can you explain that piece? So you're trying to get funding to do this very exciting project, which we know now, later turns into, it's a Nobel-worthy line of work. Right. But at the time, the people deciding whether or not to fund it don't think it's feasible. They don't think it's possible you could do this. So how did you actually do it? Did you already have some grant money and you just had to hope it worked?
Well, at that time in that grant, I had three parts, two dull parts and one exciting part. They say, drop the exciting part and do the two dull parts. So I took the money for the dull parts and used it all for gene targeting.
So if it wouldn't have worked, basically you would have been screwed.
4 years, 4 years later, I would have nothing. Because and plus, I had spent their money to do something they didn't advise.
Now, I mean, in the early days of your lab, you know, you I don't know if you had tenure yet or what, but what was motivating you to take that type of risk?
I did have tenure, but I think motivation is simply, you know, I made the assumption, I mean, and there wasn't any data to support it, that I knew that homologous recombination existed, okay? And in particularly in, for example, in mice, or at that time, and in other organisms, homologous recombination was used for sex. It was used for chromosomes. That is, you have a mother, a paternal copy and a maternal copy, and then you want to now make an individual which has mixtures of that chromosome containing parts of one and the other, and it used homologous recombination to generate that mixture. So that was what was known about homologous recombination. But I made the assumption that they would also utilize it in normal sex, in what we call somatic cells, everything but germ cells. And if it was in somatic cells, then there it should be able to work and do what I wanted, because the machinery is there. All I had to learn is how does the machinery work, and then how does it work the way I want it to work, that is to do things that I wanted rather than what nature wants to do with it. And that's what the jump was. They didn't believe that. What they argued was that the exogenous piece of DNA would never find the same sequence in the whole genome, which is 3 billion base pairs. And I said, you know, the machinery might be there. And if it is, then it has to be able to utilize it in a workable fashion. And therefore, the frequency wouldn't be impossible. And so it was a jump, essentially, how much you would believe that. They said it just wouldn't work, literally said it was impossible. And I said, I think we can make it work. And fortunately, 4 years later, we did have it work. And I sent a continuation grant to the very same study section, and they said, we're glad you didn't follow our advice. So timing is important.
And do you feel like in science today, that level of risk-taking is possible? How much of it was like you and your own personality? Yeah. How much of it was the environment, the general scientific environment? And is that type of risk-taking possible today?
Well, it's still positive today in the sense that I'm still having grants triaged. Okay. And I said, literally I sent back a note saying deja vu, it must be a pretty good idea. No, I think, I think in science you have to take risks. NIH doesn't want to take risks. You know, they want to make sure that if you give you money, that you do something useful with it. And risks don't allow you to do that. But I think in science you have to do it. And somehow we have to still, we don't have a good system for getting that. So the risk is always being taken by the scientist. And it should be the other way around. They should be, both should be taking risks. and the English system does have that. What they do, if they think somebody's really good, we'll just support that person. Okay. Somebody like Kendrew, works 25 years of trying to figure out the structure of a protein, never publishes a paper. Then it works, and then they publish and they get the Nobel Prize. Okay. But they've been supporting them for 25 years without, requiring papers. Okay. That doesn't happen in this country. Hmm. And I think it's too bad, because I think we need both. I mean, you have to take risks in order to do, really significant new stuff. And I like being in that position. I like to be working in an area where I don't feel crowded, and I have, you know, and I'm doing stuff that is highly risky, but I think if it works, there's a high payoff. And that's true of this project with anxiety. And we're doing it. I'm having a terrible time getting it funded and, you know, just battle. I think it's working and we're starting to publish papers on it. And then I think it will be accepted.
Yeah. How does, you know, you mentioned, you know, science can be set up in a way where you are supporting a promising individual and not requiring them to publish papers every year to continue getting funded and doing their work. But today in the US especially, you know, the currency is papers. You're meant to publish your work in a peer-reviewed journal, in a good one. That you know, that's the proof that you should be continued to be funded and do good work. If you're going to do it the other way and you're going to just fund an individual and give them lots of time and space to do higher risk stuff, how do you actually do that? How do you actually identify who's worth supporting?
And that's their risk.
Yeah.
It's obvious, you know, I'm sure that in England, scientists are being supported that eventually aren't productive. Okay. So it is a big risk because you're continually pouring money, but you have to have the confidence that, you know, that person, one is they have to explain what they want to do in a logical manner that says it's possible. But on the other hand, you know, they know it may take a long time before they're ready to publish. And literally some of these projects do take 25 years. It's not in the 5-year bracket. I mean, we're all set up for doing everything every 4 years because the fifth year you have to get renewed. They were willing to take that risk. And I think the Cavendish Lab in England was, you know, famous for that. They have lots of people that they were supporting in that environment and doing brilliantly in all areas, immunology, you name it, you know, crystallography, DNA structure, Watson Crick, and so on. So I think it's my feeling is that, you know, obviously it sometimes you fail when you take risk. No, that's how risk is defined, in essence, that there has to be some failures, but you have to be able to just swallow it and know that the returns are going to eventually be much greater than without doing that. But NIH has never been willing to do that system, or the U.S. has never been able to convince itself it should do that system.
So it sounds like it's sort of always basically been this way in the U.S. Has the way that science and just science generally, the way it's been funded and the way it's conducted, has it changed much in the U.S. over the course of your career?
No, it's always been tough. The only thing I always see is the negative aspects of it, that, you know, when you can't get grants because, pretty much everybody's just dependent on NIH funding for doing medical research. So I think, you just have to, I mean, literally right now, for example, it comes out of my retirement fund, the support of my lab. Okay, so that's risky also. I burn through my money all of this stuff is very expensive. And just, you know, we think it's getting cheaper and cheaper, but what's happening is actually it's getting more and more expensive simply because now we have new tools that are very expensive. So it's, there's no way to beat it. You just have to go along with it and hope. And I think, I'm sure there are failures in now, that people haven't gone through they take a big risk and they don't make it and nobody hears about it.
And so, you know, you've been at Utah running your lab for decades now. What were you doing before that? What was your PhD and your postdoc years like that set you up to get there?
Right. That was all at Harvard. And it's fantastic. I mean, it was just at the beginning of molecular biology, literally when it's being born. And, and what made it work was with people coming in, the influx from people in chemistry, biology, genetics, medicine, and so on, physics, you name it, all of them coming there together to be able to work on a new way of doing science. And it was, it was mind-boggling because you turn around, I mean, nothing was known. A protein, how do you make a protein? that was my first project, essentially. Figure out how does protein synthesis start, how does it end, and how does it continue? Okay. None of that was known. So all, you could turn in any direction and find, a significant problem. And the other thing that also was heady was that, you could work something of, a year or two and then submit a paper to sell. Okay. Now, you have to work almost 10 years to get a paper to sell. So it's a very different area and very different environment. And but it was really fun because it is it was the beginning, and and the brilliant minds from all over the world were participating in it. And I read a paper the summer before starting school at Harvard. It was by Nirenberg, and he put poly A and you got poly C. All of a sudden, wow, now here we have the tools now to figure out the genetic code and so on, so on, and so forth. And that, and similarly, regulation of genes was all Jacob and Bonomo. We're figuring out how genes are turned on or turned off. And so it was heady. It was absolutely amazing.
And so you started your lab in the 70s, so that your postdoc, your graduate school years, that must have been what, the 1960s?
Right. 61 is when I started my graduate school. And then I jumped directly. I should have gone into a postdoc, but I jumped into a position at Harvard Medical School right after being a graduate student.
And so in grad school, is that when you were working on protein synthesis?
Right.
And that was under Watson, right?
Right.
Watson, as in Watson and Crick.
As in Watson and Crick. And I think, it was, his intuition was amazing. He wasn't, he couldn't do experiments in the sense of using his hands, but he really thought, he thought about things and could figure out how nature was doing stuff. And then we did it. and he had a large lab, and there was, he took care of me like, it was amazing. I mean, as a graduate student, I have a technician.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I was producing papers, I don't know, 10 papers, I think, as a graduate student.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Just for those listening, so today, typically you'll get one, maybe two.
Yeah,
more
right.
than that would be considered remarkable.
Yeah, right. That's right. No, that's amazing.
What was what was it like working for him? What was he like, his personality and just as a person?
Extremely, very intense, very supportive, and you could do anything you wanted. I mean, we would talk with him, and he'd get us excited, and we kept going. And, he would play tricks on us. He would set up dummy, essentially, competitions saying, oh, this guy is working on something very similar. Protein synthesis start? Somebody's working just on that system. So you're working like crazy to make sure, you're not second. Because in science, unfortunately, second doesn't count. But on the other hand, what he really was, he was just friends with the other people. So, shared information, and there were things were proceeded. And I think, the atmosphere was really gratifying and very exciting. And they were tough. I mean, I had both Wally Gilbert and Watson as a mentor. And they would shred us apart when we gave lab meetings. But the good thing is that then once you got into the real world, it was a piece of cake. So you had already gone through all of that. So I think actually it's good. I mean, and, at the time you thought it was rough, but I think what the outcome is that, it made you feel more secure.
And I mean, you must have, I mean, you were around in the the golden years of molecular biology, people are figuring out how the genetic code works, what the code is, how proteins are being made, all the stuff that, I guess we take for granted today that we've known now for a long time. I mean, you must have met so many amazing scientists. Yeah. Like, did you meet Crick?
Oh yeah, he would come, you know, twice a year to the lab. Everybody. I mean, everybody knew everybody. And he would travel, you know, the whole world, multiple times every year. So he knew what all the other labs were doing, and as well as keeping it up with yourself. So it was, and you know, and what the one thing you always learn is that two brains are always better than one. Synergy is much better than competition. And I think that's a rule that's really worthwhile, because, you know, often people think, oh, you know, I'm afraid of the competition. And even if you're working on the exact same stuff, you have different reasons for doing those experiments. So again, it's always synergy wins.
Yeah. And so back then, molecular biology is this new field. We're trying to understand how biological systems work at the molecular level, at the level of DNA and proteins and things at that scale. But it was attracting people from all over. So it's like the new hot field, the ability to do these experiments and understand things at that level was unlocked by technological development. But it wasn't just biologists. You had people from physics and chemistry, everyone sort of converging in. And that's part of what made it so exciting. Is there a field of science today in biology, generally speaking, that you think is like the modern day molecular biology, where you have that kind of confluence?
I think the nearest thing is neuroscience. And again, it's getting in, you know, lots of people for computation and into the field and so on. And I think that's really healthy. So I think that's one of the reasons I'm in the field and why it's exciting to me. So I think that's the nearest thing to those. And until recently, the tools weren't there to do neuroscience. I mean, you know, people thought about it, but the tools weren't there. But now all of a sudden they're there, and they're coming in faster and faster. I mean, so it's a very exciting area right now, I think. And, you know, if I were a new scientist, I would have been going into neuroscience at the beginning. Okay, so, I think, and I don't know where the next step will be. I think neuroscience is going to occupy us for quite a while, simply because the complexities are enormous. I mean, they're staggering in essence, and, you know, because you're working with billions of interactions in our brain in millisecond timescales, where now, for example, you know, you go into a machine and they tell you to think about an apple. 15 minutes later, they can tell you where you're thinking about the apple. Okay. We need to shorten that by six orders of magnitude. And you know, and in that process, there'll be several Nobel Prizes. What can they simply look at what you can't do, and then that's where you should be looking at, and know that that's coming. And I'm sure, you know, that window will be shortened down to milliseconds in 10 less or a year less years, even though now we look at it as daunting and impossible.
And before you started your PhD, what were you doing in college? Were you doing science? Were you interested in science? Did you know that you wanted to go into research?
As an undergraduate, I was actually a political science major for the first quarter. and I looked around and I couldn't find the science in political science and switched to physics. And from then on, it was just science. And then I switched essentially to molecular biology because I went to Antioch College, which has a work study program. You work a quarter and you study a quarter and you work a quarter. And the jobs are all over the country in the fields that you're of interest. So, for example, I was working at MIT and molecular biology just starting. And then all of a sudden you get into it. And I saw, you know, forget about physics and go into molecular biology. So that's when the switch occurred, was just as a later stages of my undergraduate work, but working in it. And I worked in Alex Switzer's lab at MIT and, you know, I learned enormous amounts and had a lot of fun.
And so before that, Where did you grow up as a kid, as a teenager?
That's a long story. I grew up in the streets of Italy during the war. So I was essentially a thief for my first for 5 years, getting my own food by taking it.
So that's World War II.
Yeah, World War II.
And so in you're in Italy, you're from Italy as a child, uh-huh. You're living there. Eventually you make it to the US and get educated here. Right. When did you first get to the United States?
Well, my mother was she was actually a poet, and she got her education at the Sorbonne in France, in Paris. And then she started pamphleteering against Nazism, fascism. And then things got very hot, and she knew she was going to be picked up. And so she moved up to the Tyrol of Italy, and then that's where the Gestapo came and then took her to Dachau. And at that time, she said, you know, you're going to be better off on your own than you are with me. And that was a wise decision. But I transitioned. I lived in on a farm that she had provided funds for to take care of me. But those funds ran out in a year, so then I was in the streets from then on. But she survived Dachau, and it took her, that was in 45, and took her over a year, almost 2 years, to find me, because I was moving all the time. And then she found me, and then she had a brother living in the United States, so he sent money for a boat ride and went to U.S. In 1946.
Wow. So you got to the U.S. in 1946. Is that New York?
In New York, right. Ellis Island, and, you know, spent the night looking at the Statue of Liberty, and then processed through Ellis Island. And then, you know, I got on a car and drove to a commune. My uncle, who was a physicist, lived on a commune. And then the next day I went to school. You know, I have never been into school before, didn't know the language or anything, and proceeded.
How old were you?
Nine.
Okay, so you got here at a pretty young age. I mean, it's just like in the history books. You were at Ellis Island. You took a boat over the Atlantic. What was that? Do you remember that? What was that like?
That was a 2 weeks trip across the ocean. It was a slow boat, and it was mostly all refugees, I think, that were coming over, and before that, I'd had, you know, one hot meal in 9 years. And then all of a sudden, you go into a situation where, you know, I mean, and also, you know, no parents, to then having 65 parents on a commune. So the transition was enormous. And I was savage. I mean, I was, you know, I was a street kid. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to interact with people. And, you know, literally they said, you know, I would never learn how to read because I didn't know how to read. I've never been in school before. And so, my aunt taught me how to read, and then it proceeded. And they were so convinced that I could make it that they said, you know, this kid, you have to put him into a trade school. Mm. And they even had picked out the school and so on and so forth. The kids, what's amazing about kids is they don't question anything. The situation is just what it is. Hmm. There's no rights or wrong or anything associated with it. You simply, you know, exist in that situation that you're in. I was smart. I mean, you know, I would study people. I would study their behaviors and so on. So I'd know when, you know, first of all, money didn't make any sense. I couldn't take money from a person. If I go to a store and present them with money, they'd call the police. Okay. Where would I get money? So, you know, your values are completely different. All that's important is food and shelter. And that's what you have to, figure out how to do that on a daily basis on your own. Age four.
So you get to Ellis Island, you're living with your uncle and a bunch of other people. You learn to read. You don't start learning how to read until like the age of nine. Did you say, was that English or Italian that they taught you?
English. I wasn't allowed to speak any Italian. They want to make the transition. That was a mistake, I think. They should have maintained Italian. We could maintain 10 languages at once if we want to. But they thought I would learn English quicker if I simply never saw Italian again or heard it. So it was a complete 100% transition.
How long did it take you approximately to learn to speak and to read English?
Probably 3-4 weeks.
So okay, so you picked it up very quickly at that
very
age.
Very quick, yeah.
And, wow. And then when you finally get into school, I mean, you must have gotten into school at some point, regular grade school. What was that like? And what, like, were you a good student or did you not like school because of your childhood?
I think both. I mean, one is they simply said, okay, because you're your age, you're a third grader. So that's where I started. The teacher was really very good. She was amazingly good. When I first got there, she gave me a roll of butcher paper. This is that big rolls of paper that was just, you could roll forever. And they were studying Holland. And she said, paint a mural. I mean, she communicated, hand-wise, waving-wise, paint a mural about Holland. Everything, so windmills, ice skating, the dike, so on and so forth, cheese. Everything was in that mural. And in that process, I didn't have to have English, but I was learning English as I started the students interacting and so on. So she provided an environment which was friendly and encouraging, but they at the same time took cognizance that, it was going to take a little while. That worked. And then from then on, as a good student, I've always got good grades, but initially in that school, academia was frowned upon. There was a lot of tough kids coming from an army, barrack and so on that were at that school. And education was shunned upon. It was, you had to be there because you had to go to school, but nobody encouraged it. So nobody felt that it was a good thing to be doing. And then I switched from there in high school to a prep school. A Quaker Christian, which was completely opposite. That was a completely academic, and got you ready for college. And so I think that was very important in that transition, that all of a sudden you saw the power of education. But even then, what was really important at that time was sports and women, girls. So those were the highlights. But I still was getting good grades without doing any work. All the letters would say, you've got to concentrate, you've got to work on this, but so on and so forth. But, a kid does what he enjoys, and I enjoyed sports. I was very good at wrestling. And also, even though I was very small, I played football and then played soccer and then played baseball. So, year round, I was always sports. And then when I went to college, I just switched on the dime. Said now I would purposely went. I could have gone to sports scholarships. In wrestling, I was really good. But I went to a school that had no sports. And then right there, I said, okay, this is starting to get serious. started academics and then flourished there. And I knew I was good because a lot of the kids, this was Antioch, but a lot of the kids were coming from Bronx School of Science. In New York, and they were very good students, and I easily competed with them.
So, it sounds like, there was a lot of stuff in your early life that was outside of your control, just had to adapt to it, right? You had to separate from your mother. You had to figure out how to live on your own. You had to suddenly go to America, learn English. You were constantly put into these completely different contexts where you were just forced to adapt. Do you think that had anything to do with your style as a scientist?
I think so. Yeah. And certainly also, the commune was also really important. I mean, I don't think I could have made that transition, that biggest transition, except in that commune where 65 people are all concerned with you and in a social way. And so I think that was really important because, when I first came in, I really was an animal. They just had to tame me. and they did it, Quakers are money means nothing. Everything is service. You know, you're brought on the world to do something, to make the world a better place. And your the education is, you know, is topmost. That's the most important thing for you. And again, you know, shelter and being taken care of, and lots of activities for kids. I mean, enormous number of activities because, you know, we did all sorts of stuff that weren't available to the kids outside the community. You know, we would go into Philadelphia to the art museum and paint. No kid anywhere else was be doing that. So you're exposed to everything, and I think that was also quite meaningful. And then finally, you know, my uncle was a superb physicist. I mean, he made the first electron microscope. Hmm. He's in quantum mechanics, you know, when quantum mechanics was just being born, and participating in that. So, you know, and that background was extremely important, even though they didn't push. Nobody ever yelled. Everything was very quiet and smooth.
And so, I mean, you were obviously able to adapt and assimilate once you got to America and you started, you know, getting formal education and all of this stuff. But you mentioned being a feral kid in Italy. What do you remember from your years in Italy when you were living on your own? What was that like and what were you doing?
Literally, all you think about is food. and you'd go days without food. I mean, it's not that every day you had food. You had to take opportunity of when you had it and then eat. So that occupied you and all the time, 24 hours a day, essentially. Because, you know, if you go 3 days after without food, then you start getting hungry. And I can now still, you know, I can go 4 or 5 days without eating anything, not even thinking about it. So the body adjusts to whatever circumstance you're in. And what you think about it is, you know, what will help, okay? For example, sometimes I worked with another person, and sometimes I worked alone. And then if you find somebody that you could click with, I mean, two people are always better because one can distract and the other could do the operation. So two can always function a lot better than another separate. But if you find somebody that works, then you stick with that person. And it's always about survival.
And are you talking about stealing food? That's how you were getting it?
Oh, yeah. That's the only way I got. Nobody was going to give me anything. They didn't have anything. I mean, this is during war. So, you know, nobody ever, you know, I never thought about begging. That would have been a waste of time. So it's always you take what you can.
So you're stealing food.
And in order to do that, you have to know the situation. You have to know the people there, you know, how they function, and then take advantage of that.
And do you think... I mean, this probably forced you as a young child to be very perceptive, to watch people,
right.
to study
yeah.
their behavior and figure right. out what they're going to do next.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that does, I mean, that does keep going. I mean, I think, you know, I use my senses a lot, particularly the visual senses. And in science, you know, we see things. Seeing something is, you know, way better than anything else you could think about in terms of sensory perception. But I think, and you use those eyes very well, and you train them. I think, you know, you learn to be essentially to not be in a rush, really. You have to be patient. You have to study the situation. And then, because the people that didn't survive. So it's the Darwinian principle taking place on the streets, and I survived, and I think I survived simply because I was good at what I was doing, and took care for it, and used my senses in a helpful way than in a non-productive way.
How much did you understand? What was it like? Did you understand that there was a war going on, and did you understand like why your mother had to separate from you?
Yeah, and at that time, you know, I knew both German and Italian. So when the Gestapo came, I knew, you know, what the conversation was all about. So I knew exactly why she was going and where she was going, and that I'm likely not going to see her for a long time. I didn't know that would be forever, but. That was certainly a possibility. And then I went to, I was on a farm for almost a year before then leaving that for good.
What's the earliest memory that you have?
The earliest is actually when the Gestapo came with to pick up my mother. I've actually seen where the farm that I was on since then. They actually flashed it on the newspapers and so on. So then they had a picture of the house and I recognized it. And they took me there, and they had actually the same family was still there on the farm. And they still had all the papers from my mother that she had, poetry and so on, that she had left. They kept them, for, 60 years, and then gave them to me at that time. So I think, those are the recollections you see. But my first very memory is when they came, and it was clear that they were going to take her away.
So for those years that you were living on the street, basically by yourself, and the war's going on and you're separated from your mother, were you scared most of the time? How did it feel just to be a kid in that environment?
No, you're not scared. No, you're really concentrating on food. And, so I knew essentially where all the farms were. I knew where their chickens were. I knew how to steal eggs, you name it. I knew what was guarding that farm. It's usually big dogs, and so you had to be aware of that. But in the town, then it's all the street vendors and the small shops that were your targets.
So it sort of sounds like you're in this very precarious, dangerous situation. You're a young kid on your own, but it sounds like you were very concentrated and motivated on survival, on just getting food. Yep. Is it fair to say that this was, there was no learned helplessness, there was not a lot of anxiety. Right. You were focused on survival, but you didn't necessarily feel bad.
Right. And he also knew, that in 10 to 12 days, you have to move on. Mm. Because by that time, everybody knew who you were. And they would keep an eye on you rather than you keeping an eye on them. So then I'd have to move to a new village or new town and kept progressing, going further and further south during that whole period of time. That's why my mother couldn't figure out, where I was. She took it literally 2 years to find me.
So when you first separated from your mother and when you were a baby, what part of Italy were you in?
It's all northern, all essentially from the Tyrol down to a city called, or I guess it's a city, Reggio Emilia, which is just below, Verona is the biggest city there.
And by the time you got to America, was the war still going on or had it ended?
So, she was liberated in 45. Then she picked me up in October of 46. And then she had to go to court to get custody. And my father fought the custody. Amazingly, in Italy, it's a very paternal country. She won, so she did. She did get the custody, and then a week later, we're on the boat from Naples to New York.
Why?
Took very quickly.
I see. And did your mother stay in Italy, or did she come to America as well?
No, she came with me.
And your father stayed.
She never recovered. She never mentally recovered from Dachau.
I see.
So she really wasn't able to take care of me once we came to the United States. That's why my aunt and uncle, her brother, essentially took care of me.
I see. And so did she ever talk about it, about her experiences?
No, and I pushed.
Yeah.
I was relentless, but she wouldn't talk. She would not talk about it. Little dribbles, but nothing significant.
Mm-hmm. And why? So your parents weren't together; they were separated.
My father's in Italy. They never got married, so that was a bit of a fling, essentially. And she was very smart; she didn't marry him. He's sort of a very black person, not black, literally black, but not a well, people, no, person that took care of other people. He thought about a lot about himself.
I see.
Handsome Air Force, but not something you look up to.
And so, you know, you get to America, and it sounds like you adapt pretty quickly, and yeah, you learn the language, and you're doing okay in school, and all of this stuff. Do you recall those being? Was it exciting to go to America? Was it a happy time? Oh, yeah. Did it feel good? Yeah.
You know, my nickname was Cheerio because I was always smiling. What else do you smile about? You know, everything was available now all of a sudden. You know, I mean, it was very funny. When I first got into my house, you know, in the middle of the night, I would get up and go down to the refrigerator and take stuff. And then on one night, my uncle shows up and says, you know, you don't have to steal any of this stuff. You can have anything you wanted. Looking at it.
Oh, so you were stealing food you didn't need to steal just out of habit.
That's right.
when you were on the streets of Italy, what was the food that was the most common, or what was really exciting to get? What was your favorite thing to steal?
I mean, everything you ate was raw. I mean, so because I didn't have any place to cook it, so it's always vegetables and fruits and eggs. Eggs were probably, you know, they were big, but they were also much rarer. Mm. You know, you had to figure out where a chicken coop was and then get it. When not having dogs get you it instead. So it was mostly just fruit and vegetables. And the fruits, I could get in the trees, so I could climb trees and get whatever I wanted there, as long as it was ripe. And I think, where things got tough was, in later winter when there wasn't things that you could get outside. And so then you have to get it from the shopkeepers.
And
it's stuff that you could just run in with and then eat.
Yeah, given your early childhood and your relationship to food there, you know, you come to America and it's completely different, a different context with food. And also just like, so thinking about food and diet and your early life history, and the fact that, you know, you're still running a lab and you're still going, you know, all these years later, what's your relationship to diet today? Are you very particular with your diet? Are you disciplined with it?
Very particular. And I'm a pathological exerciser. to the point that, you know, I put in about 4 hours of exercise every day.
Oh, what do you do?
I run, I do, that cardiovascular, I row, and then I do weights.
Wow, you're still lifting. You're still lifting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And how have you always been that way? You've just always been athletic?
Yeah.
And no, how important do you think that's been just to give you like the mental endurance to have such a long scientific career?
I think so. No, I think it's really important. I think, you know, this thing loves oxygen. And so exercise will make sure that your heart's good enough to really pump away and give you the oxygen it needs. So it's a, no, and I think exercise is extremely important, and it's free. you just have to do it. And set aside the time to do it. And I think, I get up at 4:30 and do 2 hours of exercise then. And then I do 2 hours of exercise instead of eating lunch. So only eat two meals a day.
So you do breakfast and dinner.
Yeah.
And what do you like to eat? You said you were pretty disciplined about your diet.
Everything. I eat probably meat at most once a week. And so on and so forth, but very careful to eat organic. And I think pesticides are really bad for you. Mm-hmm. So I think eat quality food. And I think part of that should be green. what I eat, I change quite a bit, but I just make sure I don't eat things I shouldn't be eating. Mm-hmm. But you don't need a lot of sugar, and you don't need a lot. but I love pasta. So, you know, the one hot meal I ever had was actually pumpkin ravioli. So, and that was prepared essentially by a puta, a whore. she prepared the only hot meal I ever had while I was in Italy from, you know, age 4 onward to 9.
So, you know, thinking back, you know, just thinking, you know, you talked about how basically, you know, your life history probably influenced your scientific style mm-hmm. in many ways, your ability to yeah. adapt to new situations yeah. and just be willing to jump into new contexts yeah. and stuff.
And even, you know, be self-sufficient. Mm. You know, I think that's a big part. I mean, we, you know, we could send out to people to do tissue sectioning, for example, you know, but we do our own because we look at the Zen slides much more carefully than any pathology would. So we really try to be self-sufficient and do everything that's required and acquire the new technology that we need to do it. And I like the lab to be really capable, you know, not be restricted by technology that is encompass the technology rather than ship it out somewhere for something to be done. And in the process, you know, the reason I switched out of physics is simply because physics was getting to be bigger and bigger machines and bigger, bigger groups. And I wanted something to do with my own hands. rather than be relying on this enormous machine to be able to get your data.
And, you know, how, you know, has, you know, over the course of your scientific career in the United States, you know, going from your PhD through your postdoc to building and running your own lab, how has, you know, just across the entire field in biology and academia generally, how has like scientific culture changed over the course of your career? Has it changed in drastic ways, or is it mostly
the
same?
It does. You know, and what's also surprising is that each area, you know, when I'm in developmental biology or whether you're in cancer biology, the society associated with that is different. Mm. You know, in some fields are much more open. And, you know, in a curiosity, for example, is developmental biology was much more open than the other fields that I went into. And I would guess a big part of that is that women had a predominant role in developmental biology going back to the beginning. Mm. So it's a different culture, and it affects it, that culture. And so, you know, so those things you see, actually, you know, you just don't hear about them, you actually see them. Each field has its own peculiarities, good points and bad points. And some fields are much more hostile than others. You know, what are you doing in my turf?
What do you think determines that? What makes a field hostile?
I think that, unfortunately, I think it's often the top leadership in that field that sets the tone. And I think if you have some people there that are difficult, then that's going to be a difficult field. They have an enormous influence, I think, and rather than rather if the top people are more friendly, then the whole culture becomes friendly.
What you know, for like a PhD student or an aspiring scientist today, someone young at the beginning, how would you advise them around how to develop a sense of what they want to study and what field to go into?
I still always say, you know, go into the field that you're really passionate about. I mean, because nobody can give you that passion. So you have to have it. And people have different reasons for passion. You know, the association, family members having cancer or whatever. And I think, so to me, so you go, you know, science is really an individual enterprise. I mean, it's really the people in it that make it. And so I think what you have to do is really, you know, if you enjoy it and think about it, then you will do a good job. But if you don't, if it's not that integrated into your soul, then you're not going to do a good job. Because, you know, you never know when a good idea pops up. You know, it pops up, you know, anywhere randomly. But if you're not thinking about it, it's not going to come. So you have to be always thinking about it. It's 100%. I mean, it's people say, well, I have a family, I've got all these commitments and so on. Unfortunately, science is 100%. So you really, I think about it all the time. Middle of the night, I'm thinking about experiments, and I dream about experiments. So it's very weird.
And do you have a family yourself?
Well, yeah,
And
and she,
what part of your career did you have children?
I think, I mean, well, she's, I was in late 30s, so sort of late-ish, not way up, not early, not very early. And I think, and my daughter, she was thinking about going into science, but then she also majored in the arts, and now she's in arts, and she's completely committed to art. And art, I think, is even harder than science, because it's a in at least in science, the criteria for what's good, what works, what isn't, has to be reproducible, and so forth. And art doesn't have that. So I think, establishing what's good art and what's bad art is completely, it's almost arbitrary. It's a human whim. There are no boundaries. So I find it that art is much tougher than science.
If
The
you
objectivity is lost.
If you hadn't gone into research into being a scientist, what do you think you would have done instead?
Pathetic, I think. I'd probably be a wrestling coach.
So you were good at wrestling even as a kid.
I was really no. I could have gone to any school in the country on a wrestling scholarship.
Did you learn how to wrestle on the streets of Italy? Did you have to fight
No, I did. No, but I didn't. But I did know. You do learn things. I mean, I did have to protect my turf, though. That was a given. And when I came first to the United States, my first job was to take care of the upperclassmen. I beat up the upperclassmen that were bothering the lowerclassmen that I was in. Okay, so I became the protector of our class, and I did a good job because they had no idea what they were coming against. So it's a
What do you think, what do you think the risks and benefits of going into academia and staying in academia today are for a scientist, a young scientist, compared to when you got into things?
I think it's much tougher. I mean, the demands on a single paper are just astronomical, and I think they should do away with supplementary data. I mean, it is awful because that means that the paper never has an end. They can always ask more and stuck it in supplementary data. So I think that makes a huge difference. And I spending a huge amount of time on a single paper isn't very productive. I mean, I think it's not productive for the person. I mean, they get, more data, but they're not learning new things. They're just repeating things, and regurgitating things that people say, okay, this should be included or that should include. When it, often, no, nobody even looks at the supplementary data. They just read the main text of the paper and that's it. And here, normally, I don't know, 20, 10, well, 10 pages to a page, supplementary 30 pages. I mean, it's out of scale. And I think it's very bad for science and the students, particularly the students, because they should get, they should get a variety of experience when they're the graduate students. They should be working on one or two papers. They should be thinking a lot about stuff. And in that way, start building, what are they going to do next? And they don't have time to do that. And by the time they finish, a postdoc often is doing the same stuff they were doing as a graduate student. And that's awful. I urge all of my student graduate students to go to a postdoc completely different field. See what they are doing, see what the tools they're utilizing, and then at the end you can choose whatever you want. But broadened your experience, because I think, you know, the broader your experience, the more open your mind is to new things. And then we're quenching that. We're making him forcing him just to concentrate on one problem.
What's your opinion on the way that the peer review process for publishing papers in biology works today?
I think it's the only system that I can think of that works. So it has to be. I mean, anything else, you know, if it was an executive committee, I think it would be much worse. So I think it has to be a peer review. I think it is abused. I think sometimes, you know, people have self-interest and voice it, and that's a travesty. It's still by far the best system we have. And even, you know, our own system, I think, again, is superior simply because it's not a pyramid. I mean, there isn't one guy at the top controlling the funds for everything below. Each individual has a capability of submitting a grant and getting the money and doing what they want. And that's almost unique to the United States. I mean, it's pathetic. It's true, but it's, all the other countries have much more pyramid structure. So I complain, but it's still by far the best. So you can't complain too loud. But you can try to improve it. And I think right now we need to get broader in acceptance of risk. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we have to make risk a part of our journey and simply accept it, and then sometimes you're not going to get returns, and that should be part of the money. They know that they're going to waste some of the money, but I think they'll gain much, much more than what they lose. I think because right now we're just, it's very, I mean, I literally, that's the, you know, every time I submit, you know, they always say, the investigators, blah, 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 and then they give you no money. It's catch 22. They want you to do the stuff before you do the experiment that you're trying to get the money for. So without any money, you're not going to do those experiments. But it happens every time. I cover it daily. I mean, it's really awful. And I think they should give a little bit of leeway. You know, the best predictor of the future, the only predictor of the future, is the past. There's nothing else. And so I think you should give much more credence to that than they currently do. And if the goal is to get productivity. I think their goal should be to be productivity as well as being really going for the unexpected, because that's where new jobs really make a difference.
What do you think about the part of peer review where, what do you think about the fact that, you know, the reviewers always know the identity of the people submitting the paper, yeah, but the reviewers are anonymous?
Anonymous, right. I don't mind that. I mean, I think people will, if it wasn't, if they knew, they'd be much more guarded as to what they say. I mean, I think, you know, you should learn from the review process. You know, I love critique. I mean, if I give somebody a paper and they say it's terrific, there's nothing, you haven't learned anything. Okay. But if they say, you know, this is really foggy, red, really rip it apart, then you have something to go on and to change it and make a difference. So, you know, we should always want criticism. I mean, criticism is vital to science. But on the other hand, and I don't mind not knowing who it is, but I want them to be, you know, to be good. And I want them to be, critical. They see something I don't see. Wow, it's fantastic.
What are you most excited about in your science that's going to happen in the next few years? Are you excited that you might be able to make some major breakthroughs when it comes to understanding the neural biology of OCD and anxiety? Yeah. And if so, like, where do you think you'll be in terms of those discoveries 2, 3, 4 years from now?
I mean, I'm hoping that 3 or 4, that I'll have the whole neural circuit, essentially, from microglia, who are they talking to, starting the process all the way to the end, the behavior. And the cute thing we've just done now is we can induce the behavior and now see microglia reacting. Okay, so we can see both ends of the spectrum. We can tweak microglia, and that gives rise to behavior. We can tweak behavior and see microglia reacting. And now we have to fill in all the steps in between. I hope to do that right away. And I'm setting up to be able to do that. And that's because we don't have, particularly with behavior, we have no knowledge of that. I mean, it's zero, and the other aspect of it is that depending on where I'm in the brain, the output's different. You know, if I do it here, we get grooming. If we do it there, we get anxiety. We do it place C, we can get both. Okay.
So which parts of the brain are you talking about?
We're going into prefrontal cortex. We're going into DMS, and then we're going into amygdala. Okay, so all different control places in the brain, and so then you'll have to develop the circuitry at each of those places, and even which neurons are the first responders. Are they different in a different region because the outputs are different, so on, or is it the signals are different? Whatever. So because we have multiple channels, we'll be able to get all of that. All of that information will come out, and all the tools to do it are now. I mean, 5 years from now, we couldn't even think about these experiments. Now all of a sudden they're there, and we can do it. So I think it's an amazing time, and I think we'll have, and the other thing we found, I don't know if I mentioned it, that the two populations of cells, there's two populations of microglia, they do opposite things. So why is that? What makes one be function as accelerator, whereas the other functions a brake at the molecular level? We'll be able to define that. I hope to know that.
Is that still a mystery? The two populations of microglia, one, there's this functional difference in terms of the output you see at the level of behavior. Yeah. Do you understand anything yet in terms of markers that differentiate them or, aspects of?
We only have specific marker for one of the populations. So that's been it. And I'd like to have the gene that's responsible for the other population, we don't know. And we'd love to have that because the other hooker is always, nature doesn't use a gene just for one thing. It uses it for lots of different things. So there may be pleiotropy. So there may not exist a unique gene in the other population, for example, that specifies that population. That gene may be doing other things in other cells. So we were sort of lucky that ours was specific and gives us a marker because there's no way, right now we have sort of a marker on it, and because we have the only marker that you can use to look at that population. Okay. But we send it to Jack so that, other people can get it if they want it. But I think there is so much to be done with it. That's going to be really informative, and what it's what's going to get me excited is when I'll get a surprise that says, this is how it works, and I'm sure it's going to be a surprise in a sense because nobody knows how it works, but it may be a real surprise in the sense that a mechanism is used that nobody ever anticipated would be used for that purpose. Is that
your favorite part of the scientific process when there's just something totally surprising that comes out?
Yeah. That's real kick. Because, I thought I knew that nature was utilizing homologous recombination for something useful. But then all of a sudden, when you see that it actually does, that wow. So there's a big difference between thinking and knowing that that's the way it goes. But once spurs you on, the other then gives you important information to keep going.
And are you do you still take graduate students in your lab, or is it all postdocs? Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, I think that's not busily hustling. Nowadays, I'll tell you a story. I went to Jim and when I was still an undergraduate, I asked them, you know, if you were in my shoes, where would you go? At that time, there were only about three choices: MIT, Caltech, Harvard. He looked at me and he said, "You'd be fucking crazy go anywhere else." So I did. That was persuasive.
And how do you mentor your PhD students as opposed to your postdocs? How's your approach different for the two groups?
The real risky stuff. Well, the most risky stuff I do myself. The next lower level of risk I give to graduate students, and postdocs, as soon as they come in, they're thinking about jobs. So they don't want risk. So there is that gradation. You do make those choices. And I think, the roles are different in the sense that in a postdoc, what you're preparing them to is to run a lab. And you want them in, you know, and I know when they're ready, for example, is when they really start confronting me and arguing with me. And that's good. That's a healthy sign. And I want them to do that. And I welcome it. But that's how you decide, you know, where are they? At what level of development are they? And are they ready? And I think science is harder now, so they have to be tough. So I think you have to build that toughness in the field, and get them over the humps. I mean, most of the time in science, you do stuff and it doesn't work, or you think it doesn't work. Actually, it's I learn more from the failures than I do from the experiments that work. But and they should. I mean, they should set it up to be not only know that it failed, but know, have enough controls to know why it failed, and then be able to change it to make it work. So I think, you know, it's those subtle kind of things that they have to really on a daily basis be able to do, to be able to carry on and know that they can get, no matter what they, and particularly, you know, the one criteria I still use is say, can nature do this? And if nature can do it, I know it can be done. And that's a huge, huge thing, because with gene targeting at the beginning, we didn't even know whether we were going in the right direction. You know, you may be following this lead, and that may be a completely misleading direction to go. So you have to, you don't have a rope set up to say you know you're proceeding in the right way, and know that if this experiment works, what the next experiment work. You know, initially it's random, so, and you have to look for signals. And then if you find a signal, then it's, can we make it better? Can we make it bigger? Make the noise smaller, in essence. So I think those are the things you have to teach and incorporate it, because it's going to be a tough road for them. It's not going to be easy. But I think it's just as exciting because there's so much to learn. I mean, we're still naive. We're really naive, particularly in terms of, you know, how this thing is working. I mean, all we know is it's a really good machine.
In terms of, you know, other than the intellectual side of things, you know, being able to think about problems and being able, and also just the experiments themselves, being able to do experiments. Other than those things, which are very important, mm-hmm. What are some of the most important skills that a scientist needs to be able to develop to actually run a lab?
Presentation, and then writing, and then finally working with people, because it's a people enterprise. And none of those do we get a really good training in. I mean, you're all assumed that you'll somehow pick it up by osmosis. But, And all of those are really important. And I think if you can't communicate your science, you're lost. You know, you're completely, so you have to learn how to give talks and be comfortable with it and enjoy it and anticipate what questions you're going to get rather than just waiting and never be surprised. Okay. I always tell this, my own students, you know more about this field than anybody else in the audience. Okay. Relax. And welcome, you know, particularly a puzzling question.
Well, Mario, I want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything, are there any final thoughts you want to leave people with related to your career and your story or anything that we talked about today?
I think, one is that science is, sometimes people, degrade essentially science in the public. And I think, science has created a lot of problems, but we're also the solution. Global warming is going to be solved by scientists, period. I mean, it's not, they're going to develop the tools to be able to do something about it. I mean, obviously, the money has to come, it's going to be huge and it comes from elsewhere. But our dependency on science is even greater now than it ever was. So I think, people have to take science seriously, welcome it, and encourage it. Because without it, we're just going to go down the tube. And I mean, we're getting close. One part of the aspect of humans is they always have to go to the brink before they get even interested. You know, just almost falling off the cliff. We will. Science, and we'll need even much more science than is currently being put into the pipeline. So I think, I think anything that encourages science is a good thing. I mean, I don't believe there's anything bad comes out of science. I think science can be misused, but that's a very different thing from the science being bad. I mean, we should be able to go against, find anything. Doesn't matter what the information isn't the problem. It's utilization of that information. So I think it's, and that's a very different enterprise. So we should encourage all science and see what it tells us and then go with it. But rather than be timid. And now our pace is just too slow. And I think we need to really just spark up the activity as opposed to, giving up and desperation. There's a saying, I think, that when things get tough, you have to work harder. it's not a time to sit back. It's a time to actually put in even more effort. So I think that to me is really important. And that requires, it's an economic thing. You have to decide what your priorities are. And then go for it, but science will be the salvation. So that has to be happening. It won't happen without it, and that's true whether we're talking about medicine or not medicine. And global warming is a huge problem. I mean, it's really big, and I think people are just beginning to even think about it, rather than embracing it and saying this is what we should be doing and what the resources are. And what we spend now is trivial to what we're going to spend in the future. I mean, the longer we sit back, the more expensive it is, and fast. I mean, it's not going to be 10 years from now. It's going to be tomorrow. So I think there's urgency and there's need, certainly, I don't want to scare away people from science. I think it is tougher, but it's also, you can do so much more. So I think one thing that I always do is I'm trying to, even though they're going to have a tough time, I encourage students to go into science rather than saying, this is a bad time, weather it, go into it, make a difference. So I think we encourage students. And I think that's an important message.
All right.
And it's fun. There's nothing like it. you know, people pay us to play. How can you beat that? So I think it's a, it is important.
All right. Well, Dr. Mario Capecchi, thank you again for your time. This was really fun.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing what discoveries come out next.
Terrific. I'm hoping it lasts. No, I'm very excited. Okay. Ciao.
Hey everyone, I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more and use the code MIND, M-I-N-D, in all capital letters, to get $50 off your Lumen device today.